This is The Takeaway for October 30th. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in for Tanzina Vega. Today on the show, with the House vote set to formalize the impeachment inquiry, we'll preview what's to come on Capitol Hill. And Ukraine sits at the center of the impeachment scandal. But Ukrainian journalists say it's not exactly front page news in their country.
People can't really understand what's happened, why Ukraine is involved in this process. They know something, but it's not, you know, the main topic, and people are not interested so much in this.
Plus, there's a fight brewing over whether chimpanzees should live out their days in labs or animal sanctuaries. One animal rights advocate weighs in on the debate.
Given that they've been used in myriad ways for medical research purposes, we owe them a decent retirement.
But we start with impeachment. Let's get going. We start today in Washington, where on Tuesday, House Democrats proposed new rules around the impeachment inquiry, including plans for a more public phase of witness testimony. Testifying yesterday was
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman.
Before that, it was
State Department official Philip Rieker.
And before that,
President Trump's former top Russia advisor, Fiona Hill.
U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland.
Former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
Witness after witness after witness. Each person in this parade of testimony plays a role in the impeachment puzzle, and today we'll sort it all out. And we'll also pull the curtain back on what it means for a career civil servant to testify, possibly in defiance of the White House. What are the risks and what are the costs? Joining me now are Karun Demirjian, congressional reporter at The Washington Post, and Siobhan Hughes, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi to you both.
Hello.
Karun, Nancy Pelosi announced this week that the House would hold a vote on impeachment on Thursday. What exactly will House members be voting on?
They're going to be voting on a package of rules and regulations, basically, for how they're going to be conducting the rest of the impeachment inquiry going forward. It's going to give them a structure that they can kind of hold up to everybody of how they're going to handle the closed-door hearings, how they'll handle the open hearings, how they will handle questions about due process, how they will basically conduct themselves in an impeachment inquiry that's going to be highly scrutinized. And it's a sign from Democrats that they feel like they're in a good place to signal to everybody that they are full steam ahead. They are going in the direction of impeaching the president. This is not an impeachment vote itself, but it is a establishing how it will take place in the next several weeks ahead.
And how will this affect the inquiry moving forward?
Well, it doesn't affect the general trajectory of the inquiry that much, to be perfectly honest. I think that House Democrats were feeling very good about the last few weeks of witnesses that they had come in. Some have given testimony that's fairly incriminating of the president and his inner circle when it comes to Ukraine policy. So they're going to continue building those blocks, bringing in these witnesses will agree to come. There's some court challenges that are slowing down the process with some people that could be key witnesses. But generally speaking, they've been building this case from the State Department, from the National Security Council angle, pulling in different people, sometimes from energy, from DOD. And they're in the corroboration phase right now of the story they feel like they already have to eventually tell to the public that will form the basis for the articles of impeachment that everybody is expecting them to file and vote on successfully before the end of the calendar year.
Siobhan, Tuesday's 10-hour-long testimony from Alexander Vindman seemed particularly important considering he was listening in on the call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. What do we know so far about Vindman's testimony?
Well, we know two things. Number one, the new information that Colonel Vindman came forward with is that the transcript of that call, some key words, at least from his perspective, had been omitted. It doesn't change the basic information that we know about that phone call. Things like Burisma, the name of that gas company, were mentioned, but it is going to raise questions about how the White House handled the transcript and record of that call. Separately, what we know from Democrats is that Republicans used that closed-door hearing to try to get Mr. Vindman, Colonel Vindman, to divulge the identity of the whistleblower whistleblower. Now, Republicans say they were only trying to find out where Colonel Vindman got his information so that they could understand his biases. But nonetheless, it does heighten the concerns that Democrats and others have about the privacy of the whistleblower and then also this person's security.
And commentators on Fox News and some Republicans are attacking Vindman's credibility in part because he was born in Ukraine, even though he spent most of his life in the U.S. How do congressional Republicans view Vindman's credibility as a witness, Siobhan?
So that tactic backfired. Liz Cheney, who is the chair of the House Republican Conference, called those attacks on Colonel Vindman shameful. Republicans clearly wanted no part of that. But that said, Republicans are simply saying that Colonel Vindman got it wrong, that while they appreciate his service, they disagree with his assessment of what President Trump did. And we should also note that in his opening statement, Colonel Vindman came out and flat out said that he was concerned by Donald Trump's phone call. He said that he went to White House lawyers twice, once about the phone call and once also about a July 10th meeting in which the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, brought up investigations to some Ukrainian officials, basically as a condition for securing a White House meeting. So Democrats view that as very credible, but Republicans simply said Colonel Vindman had no basis to be concerned.
And Siobhan, give us a rundown of where we're at in terms of witnesses in this inquiry overall. Like, how many people have come through so far? How many more could we expect?
Sure. So 9 people, including Colonel Vindman, have testified so far. They've predominantly come from the State Department. On Wednesday, 2 more people, State Department officials who had worked for Kurt Volker, the special envoy to Ukraine, are coming forward. A big one, though, is going to be on Thursday when Tim Morrison, a National Security Council official, testifies. This is somebody who doesn't pull any punches. We know from briefings that he has given to the acting ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor, that he has been concerned about what he saw in the White House. And after that, the Democrats are interested in hearing from some high-profile people. It's not clear they're going to get them as witnesses, such as the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and then also John Bolton, the national security advisor who was fired in September.
And Karun, for those who haven't been following carefully, who are these folks generally? Where do they work? What are their backgrounds? What are they saying? Like, have most of the witnesses viewed President Trump's relationship with Ukraine in any particular way?
For the most part, the witnesses that have come forward have been career or if they're politically appointed officials, they are people that have been following this region very closely and have job titles that show they have currently or very recently when these things were going on, had responsibilities in this area of the world. So you've had National Security Council officials that were senior directors and directors for Europe and Russia policy come in. You've had State Department officials that were either specifically tasked to Ukraine or tasked to Europe, which had oversight of Ukraine from a higher up level. And that's been the general gist of the people that you've had come in. For the most part, they have all been adding to parts of the, either corroborating or adding to parts of the narrative of the how there was a regular Ukraine policy that was being pursued by the national security officials in the administration. And then there developed this shadow Ukraine policy that was being directed more by Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, that seemed to have buy-in from Trump's acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, where there were the quote-unquote three amigos that were appointed to run it after the ouster of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Masha Yovanovitch. And so they're all telling parts of this story. I would say probably the one exception to this, and the person whose testimony has been called into question by many of these people, is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. This is going to get a little bit more into the weeds, but we know from the text messages that Kurt Volker, the former special envoy to Ukraine, provided to the impeachment investigators that Sondland was defending Trump to some of his colleagues in the diplomatic circle, saying there's no quid pro quo here when he was challenged by people like Bill Taylor, who, by the way, has given the most detailed roadmap type testimony to this impeachment inquiry. people like Bill Taylor, people like Vindman yesterday, their testimony basically says, Sondland, you weren't telling the whole truth, or you weren't being very candid about what the truth was here. And that's raised questions about, well, were there people who were blocking for the president? Sondland is one of the quote-unquote three amigos that was appointed along with Volker and Rick Perry, the energy secretary, to run this side channel Ukraine policy that seemed to be connected to Giuliani. And so it's interesting that his testimony is not matching up with the testimony of many others. But then, of course, this begets the whole political back and forth where you have the GOP saying, well, that's very nice that all these career officials don't think that the president was up to any good, but they don't have firsthand information the way that people like Sondland did. But as Siobhan was saying earlier, that Vindman's testimony yesterday kind of broke that logjam because you have somebody who was listening to that call between the two heads of state, between Trump and the Ukrainian president, and somebody who was directly briefed by the participants in some of the more contentious meetings that have gone towards what Democrats believe establishes a quid pro quo. They directly told him what their intentions were. They told Vindman what their intentions were, and he can then turn around and tell investigators that, which is what he did yesterday.
And Siobhan, the focus of much of the reporting on impeachment seems to be, was there a quid pro quo? But what else are we seeing come out of the testimony? Is there anything that's still missing for you?
A lot of the pieces of the puzzle have been filled in, but it's the textual details that have been missing. So when did people inside the White House and at the State Department first realize that Rudy Giuliani was directing this shadow policy? To what extent did they try to push back? How did President Trump communicate to Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney that he wanted the military aid to Ukraine to be withheld? How was he so successful in concealing what he was doing from the senators who really were in the dark about what was happening until late August and early September?
And now let's talk, Siobhan, about the process for one of these people, witnesses in the impeachment inquiry. There was some reporting in the New York Times that said it can cost something like $15,000 for someone to testify. Where do these costs come from?
So it's very expensive to hire a Washington, D.C. lawyer to defend you before Congress. It's hundreds of dollars an hour. This lawyer is helping you prepare testimony. This lawyer is sitting with you in the deposition room for 9 or 10 hours while you as a witness take questions from lawmakers and counsel. This lawmaker is advising you on the follow-up. This lawmaker is negotiating behind the scenes with staffers over the terms of your testimony. And so the expenses can really add up.
And why is it important for these witnesses to get legal advice before they step into this process quickly?
These guys, number one, are in legal jeopardy. You know, they don't know if their actions are going to be questioned by Congress. They don't know if President Trump and the White House will come after them as traitors. And they need to protect themselves.
Khaydoun Demirjian is a congressional reporter at The Washington Post, and Siobhan Hughes is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for joining me.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
The ongoing House impeachment inquiry has put Ukraine directly in the spotlight. And journalists there, as here, are trying to make sense of the latest developments in this investigation and how they affect what's happening in their home country. But press freedom in Ukraine has seen ups and downs in recent years. While there have been some improvements since the 2014 revolution, Ukrainian journalists still face an uphill battle. Earlier this year, an investigative journalist was violently killed in a Ukrainian city. And just last week, a journalist reporting in a contested region of eastern Ukraine was sentenced to 15 years in prison by pro-Russian separatists. Today, we're joined by two Ukrainian journalists. Nastya Stanko is deputy editor-in-chief of the independent media channel Hromadske, and Anna Babinets is editor-in-chief of Slidstva Info, an independent investigative journalism agency. They are both here in New York to receive Courage in Journalism Awards from the International Women's Media Foundation. Nastya and Anna, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Thank you.
Anna, to start off, how is this impeachment inquiry into President Trump being talked about in Ukraine?
Actually, this is not so big like in the United States. First, because Ukraine is not a very big geopolitical player, and people usually are not very interested in geopolitical things. And second is because it's mostly about impeachment of United States president, not about impeachment of Ukrainian president. But of course, it's in daily news, it's everywhere, not so big like in the United States, but journalists, activists, politicians, people who understand that it's important geopolitical processes and Ukraine is part of it, they are, of course, interested in it. So yes, it's in news, but it's not so big like it's in the United States.
Well, Ukrainian President Zelensky was elected after campaigning as an anti-corruption reformer. So has some of what we've learned about his relationship with the United States hurt his reputation?
Yes, actually, when I was reading this call, of course, the most important thing I found there, it was when Zelensky told Trump that after election, he will have his own general prosecutor, the person who Zelensky will control at all. So it's not how things should work, because general prosecutor is independent person. President can't have any his own official. For me, of course, and for many people in Ukraine too, it sounded like corruption, intentions of corruption. You know, that Ukraine has very deep corruption tradition, and of course it's bad signal, red flag for us, for Ukrainians, for journalists.
And Nastya, President Zelensky seems to have been forced into the international spotlight as a result of this call with President Trump, potentially tying foreign aid to investigation into the Bidens. How would you say he's been handling his moment in the spotlight?
He said today that we're fighting with corruption, but we are not finished to fight. You know, it's like 5 months as he is the president. And I think that President Zelensky has some problems with also our foreign partners, I mean European partners as France and Germany, because of this call, because like he repeat after Trump that Germany and France don't help enough. And now President Zelensky, like he said also that he wants to be that president who will finish the war for 1 year, and he wants to prepare this meeting between four presidents, you know, like Putin, Zelensky, Merkel, and Macron. And we can't do this for different reasons. And I think that because also of this call when President Zelensky said that, they are not helping enough.
And Nastya, are Ukrainians sympathetic to Zelensky's position?
This is very difficult, actually, topic. I think it's difficult also for U.S. citizens, you know, but for us, this like names Bolton or Kurt Volker, Bill Taylor, or this new guy, Windman, it's very complicated things, you know, and people can't really understand what's happened, what is like, how it will be impeachment in U.S., why Ukraine is involved in this process. They know something, but it's not, you know, the main topic, and people are not interested so much in this. The main topic, this is war and how to finish the war, because people are suffering because of this and they want to finish this war, you know?
And Nastya, you've reported from areas of conflict in Ukraine, and Ukraine, as you said, is still in an ongoing war with Russia. From your perspective, is it clear that the country can count on the U.S. for aid like it has in the past?
Yeah, we need this support, I mean military aid from US, because we try to normalize this peace process. But of course, nobody believes Putin, you know, even our president, I think, don't believe Putin. And nobody in Ukraine believes Putin, you know, nobody. I think that's why we need this protection, you know, and we need this powerful partner. And doesn't matter who will be the president of US.
And Anna, you've done extensive reporting on corruption in Ukraine. Earlier this year, journalist Vadim Komarov, who also focused on uncovering corruption, was killed. So what does his death tell us about the safety of journalists in Ukraine?
I'm very happy that investigative journalism is very popular in Ukraine because I've been working as a journalist for last 17 years. And for last 6 years, right after revolution, for many young people, young journalists, it's very interesting to be investigative reporters, because it's not only interesting, because they feel it's safe. It's not totally safe, of course, but if we compare with times of Yanukovych with previous times, it's better, yeah. If it's absolutely safe, I can say that everyone, every Ukrainian journalist can feel safe, even in Kyiv. I'm not saying about frontline, yes, because it can happen. Of course, we have all the security, all this digital encrypted messages. We use all the things for not being covering if, for example, some security service, because we had these cases in Ukraine when security service were following journalists, when they reading, listening their phone calls, reading their texting. So, of course, we don't want to be discovering, we don't want that people from authority know our what we are talking about. So yes, of course, we do all this like standard things which investigative journalists around the world do.
Anna Babinets and Nastya Stanko are Ukrainian journalists receiving Courage in Journalism Awards from the International Women's Media Foundation. Congratulations to you both, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
A few years ago, the National Institutes of Health decided it would no longer conduct experiments on chimpanzees in the U.S.
A larger number of these chimps were bred for HIV/AIDS research, which did not go well. They were used in toxicity testing. They did a variety of types of research that involves hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C research.
That's Lori Gruen, a professor of philosophy at Wesleyan University. She's also an animal rights scholar who is among those pushing for the transfer of these endangered animals from research facilities to sanctuaries. But recently, an NIH panel voted that a New Mexico research facility would retire each of its 44 chimpanzees to its own labs rather than moving them to a national chimpanzee sanctuary in Louisiana called Chimp Haven. And although NIH research on chimpanzees has stopped, advocates like Lori are concerned about what keeping them in labs could mean for their well-being.
There's about 1,400 chimpanzees in captivity in the United States. A little over 230 of them are in zoos, and a little under 370 are in laboratories. And the most chimpanzees live in sanctuaries. 640 live in sanctuary in the United States, and half of those, 300-ish, are living in Chimp Haven, which is our national chimpanzee sanctuary.
And in 2015, the government banned biomedical research on all chimpanzees and said that all chimps that are owned by the United States would be retired. But as of now, as you said, some of these retired animals are still living in research labs. Will you just describe their living conditions for us?
Well, they're variable. In many of the laboratories right now, the chimps do have indoor and outdoor areas. Some of them live in open-air corrals. Some of them live in what are called primadomes, and they're in various different size groups. Some are in very small groups. Some are in larger groups. Chimpanzees in the wild live in large fission-fusion societies, and so larger groups are always more socially appropriate for chimpanzees. And in sanctuaries, they have much more room to move, they have more naturalistic habitats to explore, and they tend to be able to live in larger groups. The very reason these sanctuaries exist is to satisfy the chimpanzees' interests, needs, wants, preferences, desires. That's their whole purpose. Hmm. And laboratories, that's not the purpose. They have to satisfy certain minimal interests, minimal needs, but their purpose in laboratories is and was to produce medical and scientific knowledge, which is a very different framework, a different attitude for thinking about the animals.
Last week, a National Institutes of Health panel decided that it would not relocate 44 retired chimpanzees to this chimp sanctuary. Explain this decision to us. Why did they say this? Why don't they want to relocate these animals?
One of the things that happened when the government, when the NIH decided that it was time to move all the chimps to the National Chimpanzee Sanctuary, which is Chimp Haven, the laboratories, of course, didn't want that to happen because they were going to be losing per diem. What's per diem? Well, The government pays the laboratories and the New Mexico facility to hold the chimpanzees there. And the cost of holding them in the laboratories and in the New Mexico facility is much higher than the cost of retiring them to sanctuary. So there's a financial interest on the part of those who are running the laboratory and other holding facilities. And what they were saying is that the chimps are not healthy enough or they're too sick. Sicknesses that they got while they were at the New Mexico facility, and decided that all of the chimps should stay in New Mexico.
And who were the people who were on this panel that made this decision not to relocate the chimpanzees?
There are three veterinarians from the National Institutes of Health. The three veterinarians are not chimpanzee experts, and they are also in some ways going to defer to the veterinarian who is on site at the New Mexico facility. The panel did not go to Chimp Haven, and they didn't go to the New Mexico facility, so they never met the chimpanzees. But I think to make it a less biased panel, the veterinarian from Chimp Haven should have been a part of the conversation, just as the veterinarian from New Mexico. Because one of the things that this particular panel decided to go along with the head veterinarian about was that some of the chimps are bonded to one another. So even if they're not that sick, and there are 17 of the chimpanzees that are in their 30s, so these aren't old and frail chimpanzees, but they said that they were bonded to other chimps that were there. Well, without meeting the chimps, without understanding what their sort of social opportunities would be like, it's very difficult to say that they were bonded, and a chimpanzee behavioral expert who met the chimpanzees would probably be in a better position to do that.
Did they provide any information about how sick these animals are or what their conditions are? Why would it be too dangerous to move them?
Most chimpanzees in captivity have some form of heart disease. Captivity is a stressful thing for a chimpanzee, a wild animal. They're not domesticated. And so heart disease is not unsurprising. We see it in zoo chimps. We see it in sanctuary chimps. We see it in lab chimps. These chimps at New Mexico, many of whom are noted as being obese, have heart conditions and diabetes, which is exacerbated by obesity. And the question you might want to ask is, why are they obese? Why aren't they getting exercise? Why is their diet such that they're obese? And that question was not addressed at all by any of the veterinarians who made this decision.
Is the quality of health services for these chimpanzees better at a research facility than what they would get at a sanctuary like Chimp Haven? Is that why they decided not to relocate them?
No. Chimp Haven is accredited by all of the same organizations that the laboratories are accredited by, and in addition are accredited by two sanctuary organizations. But the attitude of the veterinarians at laboratories is very different than the veterinarians at Chimp Haven. And that's because the goal of the animals in laboratories is to provide useful scientific information. The idea there is to make sure that when you euthanize an animal, it's done properly. That's a veterinary concern. Of course, if there has to be a euthanization at the sanctuary, that has only to do with the health of the animal, not to do with the medical purpose.
And what do you think all of this says about what happens to animals after we stop using them for research? What should we really be prioritizing when it comes to the well-being of these animals?
Chimpanzees can live into their late 50s in captivity, and they are socially complicated individuals. And given that they've been used in myriad ways by us for medical research purposes, my view is that we owe them a decent retirement in sanctuary where they can be respected and they can be cared for beyond their role as tools for research. As individuals who have rich and meaningful lives, lives that matter to them, and that they can be cared for and tended to and respected and admired. And so I think that in the case of all of these chimpanzees, the presumption should be that they, unless they're going to pass away in transport, which means they're so, so sick that they're going to die within the next week or two, they should all be in sanctuary.
Lori Gruen is an animal rights scholar and professor of philosophy at Wesleyan University. Lori, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's all for today. If you want to weigh in on anything you heard on today's show, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. We're on Twitter at The Takeaway. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back again, download our podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Gonzalez Sarah A. Tanzina is back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.